Lecture 2. The Adversary System.
Well, before talking about conflict management in the 20th century and the 21st century, we need to go back about 2,500 years and talk about the invention of the adversary system by the Greeks in the 6th century BC. So that's this lecture, the adversary system. In it, we'll explain what it is. We'll talk about the objections to it raised by Socrates and Plato that are pretty fundamental, and they're still with us today. We'll talk about how Aristotle championed the idea that we should use the adversary system, that we should test what's most probably true by arguing back and forth in order to settle disputes and differences. We'll explain how that was the greatest single advance in conflict management in human history, probably, how it vastly reduced the amount of violence, how it gave us great possibilities for democracy and court systems. But it also brought with it a downside that we're going to need to understand because it limits the way we handle conflict today. I want you to think in terms of two main reasons why we need to understand the adversary system. One, you can't escape it. It's still here today. We use it all over the developed world. We engage in adversary systems, processes in order to resolve disputes, settle cases in court, handle minor disputes, make democracy work. We're still using it. And so if you want to be a full participant and you want to be effective at getting some of your own disputes handled, you've got to be able to use the adversary system. That's one reason. There's a second reason. And that second reason is that there's a downside to it. And the downside, which was sort of pointed to in those objections raised by Plato way back 2,500 years ago, is that there is within it the assumption that a conflict is a competitive kind of event, that in order to get a winner, you have to get a loser. And that brings us some downsides we'll have to pay attention to. We'll end the lecture by offering you some serious tips on winning arguments in an adversarial process. We won't go through a whole course on argument, but we'll give you some tips on how to do that. So let's begin. Go back now. Let's go back to that 6th century BC. And let's talk about how the ancient Greeks invented the adversary system. The Greeks fought with each other a lot. It was normal in the cultures of the city-states to go to war every spring and in the summer and then nurse their wounds and settle up who won what over the course of the winter. They fought with each other a lot. And it was damaging. It cost lives, it cost money, it destroyed things. And somewhere in there, they began to realize that all this fighting is terribly costly. And somebody began to think there must be a better way. We have no idea who actually thought of it first, but it began to be used in Athens and in some other city-states fairly early on in the 6th century BC, and certainly once you got well into the 5th century BC. And what they started doing was substituting arguing with one another and then having someone judge who won, substituting verbal combat, in a sense, for physical combat. So here's what they're doing. They pick somebody that they trust to serve as judge. And then if you and I have a dispute, I argue my side, you argue your side, we present our cases to the judge, and the judge says, based on those arguments, here's who I think wins and makes an award. And they agreed that that was better than having us fight it out. It really was. Of course, over time, they systemized this. They began to do some very different things. They, instead of taking cases to the oracle or dunking people in water to decide if they were guilty, they began to use presenting arguments and defending themselves to decide guilt or innocence. And then in ancient Athens, they came up with democracy using the adversary system. Having been through a period where they'd had several really nasty tyrants in a row. One of those died. Who was going to be in charge now? How were we going to do the government became the question. And instead of just having someone else rule absolutely, they decided for the citizens of Athens to meet in assembly, argue back and forth, and decide policies by vote. So they brought the adversary system into decision-making in government and in the doing invented democracy. As they went about this, the Greeks, they placed a great deal of trust in, emphasis on, human reasoning. They sort of understood emotions as powerful human forces, stuff that originated among the gods that needed to be respected, but it needed to be dominated and controlled by reason. So they really placed great stock in reasoning. And a cornerstone of the reasoning process the Greeks used and gave to us is what we call the principle of non-contradiction. As Aristotle put it, the principle of non-contradiction says that a thing cannot be and not be at the same time. If I'm a this, I can't be a that. If it's here, it can't be there. They sorted things into categories, and if something was in one category, then it was not in another. The principle of non-contradiction. If it's in this category, it's a contradiction to say it's also in that category. So we have to decide which it is. So it kind of has a sense of reducing things to black and white yes or no thinking. It's very, very useful, but there's a limit built into that. And that's going to be tied to this idea of competition that was involved. So as the Greeks began to do this, using the adversary process and developing it, they had their ways of going about it. Disputants in ancient Greece didn't have attorneys. They were required to present their own case. And you know what that did? It created a market. There were advantages in the wealth you could gain settling disputes, in the status you would have being persuasive in your arguments in the assembly. If you were skillful at arguing, if you could succeed as an adversary over someone else and get your way, there were advantages to that. So there was a market for this knowledge and skill. There were teachers in ancient Greece who taught a lot of things. They were called sophists, and that translates roughly into professor or teacher in general. And sophists began to respond to the market by teaching rhetoric and debate. One of them, Protagoras, became known as the father of debate because he clearly articulated that it's a good idea to test truth by having both sides argue one against the other to see what happened. Plato and Socrates really objected to this approach. Articulated by Plato, this approach seemed to privilege winning over getting at the truth. So Plato objected. He took the position that this was wrong. We shouldn't do it this way. We shouldn't have people deciding this way. And we shouldn't be teaching people this because it privileged winning over truth, and proving truth was a more important value. Aristotle, Plato's leading student, came along and said, you know what? I don't agree with that. It should be easier to argue the case if I'm on the side of truth. The evidence should be better. The reasoning should be clearer. It should be easier to make the case for truth. So yes, we should go ahead and do this. Well, Aristotle won that argument. Athens kept its adversary system. And then the Romans, when they came along, bought into the adversary system. And they built it into their teaching system. They built a system of education which built on what was called the seven liberal arts. And one of those seven basic things that you had to know was rhetoric. That's how to argue to make your case successfully in any adversarial process. So rhetoric was taught as part of basic education, and it stayed through the Romans and into medieval times. But Plato has remained very influential, and in part that's because he wasn't just 100% wrong. Aristotle was right, but you know what? Plato wasn't absolutely wrong. Sometimes this system does privilege winning over getting at the truth. So in civilization today, we still have our doubts about rhetoric in the adversary system, and we have those doubts for very good reasons. We may have doubts, but given that we still employ it, we need to know something about how to argue because we're going to be likely to be involved in it. That influence of Plato and that suspicion is still around because that underlying flaw in the adversary system is still going to be present. The adversary system has been developed and improved. What do we mean developed and improved? Well, if you look around all over the world, we have developed professions that can help and be trained and learn a lot about it. We've refined it and evolved it. We have standards for practice. We have standards for arguments, standards for being more sure. We license and insure the professionals who help us out. We've expanded it in terms of, we just don't use it in court, but organizations use it. We have procedures that are quasi-formal, where we resolve things in grievance procedures and disciplinary procedures. So it's been expanded and it's been refined. You're not going to escape the adversary system unless you're a very rare individual in the developed world. We can all be expecting to be involved with it sooner or later, in the court as a plaintiff or a defendant, or certainly as a juror. We're going to get there one day, most probably. In our organizations, we're going to have to make cases. And all of us who live in democracies have got to listen to the politicians make their case and decide who's right. And we got to make it on a pretty good basis. Democracies can be pretty muddled. There's a lot of special interest. There's a lot of money. There's a lot of media. We worry about our democracies these days, but politicians still have to make their case, and we still have to judge. I'm often comforted by what Winston Churchill said about democracy, which went something like, nobody pretends that democracy is perfect. In fact, democracy is the worst form of government ever invented, except for all the others that have been tried. So that was democracy. That's what Churchill thought, and that made very, very good sense. We need to know about argument. We got to evaluate arguments as a citizen. And then, of course, in business, we need to make accountable decisions, and we make to make pitches for them. We need to know about argument for that. We're going to be involved. So you got to develop some skill in argument. Now, as I said, this is not a course in argumentation. This is a course in conflict management. There's a wonderful course in argumentation offered by the teaching company that's done by Professor David Zarefsky. But here, I want to give you some tips. I can't leave this lecture without giving you some tips on argument. And there are six big ones, as far as I'm concerned, that if you can get those right, you're a long way down the road toward being pretty good at argument. Start with tip number one. There's a process called forensic reasoning. That's the way that we think. And tip number one is understand forensic reasoning. You're going to have to use it to define terms, and you're going to have to use it to build and evaluate the arguments as you go. Here's how forensic reasoning works. There's always some general principle. In the case of court, it's the law. The law says, do not kill somebody. The law says, don't go over this speed in a given traffic area. There's a law or a rule that's stated. It could also be, in a more general sense, outside of court, in just some stated general principle. So you got to have a general principle that you're concerned with for forensic reasoning. The other thing you have to have is facts, a set of facts about what actually happened. And so what we're going to do in forensic reasoning is compare how the facts fit against the general principle. In criminal trials, which is where most of us would be most familiar with that, because we've at least seen it in fiction if we've never been accused of anything or even served on a jury. In a criminal trial, what happens is there's a law which establishes that general rule. And what the prosecutor then needs to do is to go and prove, to document that certain facts took place. This individual did these things. Those are facts. And then what we need to do is compare those documented facts to what the law says and decide whether they fit within the law or whether that action was outside the law. And if we decide the action was outside the law, the jury decides the person was guilty in that instance. So forensic reasoning, general rule, specific facts. How do the facts fit against that general rule? If I get the idea of forensic reasoning, then I've got a nice start down the way toward being able to argue effectively. All right, that's tip number one. Let's go to tip number two. Second tip, and it's kind of got a couple of pieces in it. I need to put them together. The basic tip is recognize the issue, and with it, recognize the starting point for the argument. We not only need to figure out what it is we're arguing about, but we also need to figure out who needs to make the case. So recognize the issue and the starting point. Here's how that works. The issue is the thing that we have a difference over, the thing that's going to be decided. If it's a court case, is John Doe here guilty of committing this crime? That's the issue that's being decided. If it's a policy issue, should we adopt this new law, pass this new law? The issue decided is, should we pass this new law? That's the issue that's being decided. But there is the question of the starting point, and I want to talk to you a little bit about that. The starting point is really, if you think of it as what would go ahead and happen if nobody brings this argument up, if nothing is said, what is the case now? If the question of guilt in a court is being decided, the starting point is the person is innocent. If he's not arrested, if he's not accused, if the prosecutor doesn't prove the case, we'll still assume that the person is innocent. Well, that's what we would have assumed if nothing ever came up. How do we recognize that starting point? I like to go back because I've studied this some and think in terms of the writings of Richard Whately, who was the classic theorist of argument in the 19th century, and much of his thinking carries right through into our own time. The way Whately put it was, there is a presumption in favor of the status quo. Status quo is just Latin for what we have now. We're going to presume that what we have now is okay unless somebody persuades us differently through argument. Presumption in favor of the status quo. The classic example in court of innocent until proven guilty really fits this. We choose to assume that a person in this society is innocent until the government proves that that person is guilty, because we really value not locking up somebody who might be innocent. So we say the defense doesn't have to prove innocence, doesn't even have to establish probable innocence. Defense just has to keep the prosecutor from proving the person is guilty. The starting point in the argument in court is a person is innocent, okay? But that same starting point issue applies in any kind of an argument anywhere. So let's think of another example. Remember the example of the salesman back in lecture one who had this territory that he wasn't happy with because he was driving these 40-mile stretches and he thought he was spending too much time in the car? The starting point of that issue is what the salesman's territory is now. There's a presumption in favor, in Whately's terms, of the status quo. What's the status quo? It's the territory he's got now. If he wants to use an adversarial process, go make the case, make the pitch through argument for a change in his territory, it's on him to make the case, to show the boss with reasons and evidence why it would be better for the company to change that territory. So the burden is on him. In the court system, we talk about it being a burden of proof. The burden of proof is on the prosecution because the prosecutor has got to prove a person's guilty. Argument theorists these days, instead of saying burden of proof, which is actually the term Whately used for all kinds of issues, what we more often say now is the burden of persuasion. The burden of persuasion is on that salesman to make the pitch for making the change that he seeks in his own example in the territory. So that's tip number two. Let's go to tip number three. I want to suggest that you make a very careful effort to consider the credibility of whatever serves as evidence when you identify what are the facts or even what's the principle you're trying to consider. This one we miss a lot today, and it concerns me more and more in the age of the internet when there's nobody really screening for us what's the probability that this person who's saying this on the internet even knows what he or she is talking about, let alone is not biased. It's harder to evaluate the credibility of what passes for information. But in the argument sense, we really do need to evaluate the credibility of the evidence we're getting. What's the source of that evidence? That is a serious question I got to ask. I got to go back and say, okay, what is the source of this evidence? My first question about that source in evaluating credibility is, do I have reason to believe this person or this institution knows what they're talking about? Now, I might find that out by looking, what's their expertise? What are their credentials? Was that person an eyewitness? But if I'm going to accept the testimony of a human being or an institution about a fact that's being contested, I can't just run that off of they say so. I've got to decide, do I have reason to believe what they're saying when they say so? And the first aspect of that is, do I have reason to think they know what they're talking about? There's another aspect. I better stop and think, should I suspect this person's biased on this? How objective would they be? Might they have a conflict of interest? So what I'm looking for is someone who's got plenty of expertise, knowledge about a subject when they testify, and it could be an institution for that matter, or that the information's been screened so that we know it's somebody who knows, and that it's reasonably objective. Now, that's an impossible standard in any absolute sense. Any human who knows much about a subject has got a bias about it. In reality, as our knowledge of any given subject goes up, so does our interest in it, our bias, our connections with parts of it, our even attachment to things we might have said in public before. So as we become more experts, so does our bias go up. They tend to go together. But we really still need to have evaluated the credibility of the evidence presented in any argument. And that runs on expertise and degree of objectivity. And we want as much expertise and objectivity as we can get. It's never perfect. But I ought to be able to make a judgment that, yes, this person or this institution can be trusted to make this claim that I'm taking as evidence. So that's tip number three. Let's go to tip number four. Check your logic. Now, we've all been learning to reason since we were little bitty kids. We can get much better at logic. We need to work on it always and get better at it. But here, I don't want to suggest a whole set of technical things about logic. What I want to suggest is, in this tip, is that you check your own reasoning. What we tend to do when we're in an adversarial situation is we get all wound up about the point we're making, we believe our side, we've got some intensity behind that, so we don't notice the little leaps that we're taking that don't really make sense. We don't notice when we're going from two examples to a generalization about a whole category of things, for instance, which would be called a hasty generalization. We don't notice that the conclusions we're drawing don't really solidly flow from the evidence that we've got. So what I want to suggest in a chip is always check my logic. Back up. Get skeptical about my own thinking as I'm working out an argument. Don't just think, hey, wow, that's a good argument because I'm excited about it. Back up, doubt it, check my own logic, and really try to see for myself if the reasoning that I'm following here really leads to the conclusion I'm drawing. That's tip number four. Okay, let's go to tip number five. And it sort of flows off of checking my own logic. Let's consider what the opponent's logic might be. Tip number five is consider the arguments that my opponent, whoever is on the other side, might bring up. And those arguments would occur in two forms. One is that just might be their original argument about the case. I say, here's my reasons for. They may say, here's my reasons against. So they're original arguments in whatever goes back and forth. I better consider what are all the possible arguments an opponent may bring up and think about how I might answer those arguments. I need to have good answers to their arguments to win in an adversarial process, not just my own good argument. I also need to think about what the opponent might say in response to my arguments. What might their answers be to what I'm saying? And I have to think about how I'm going to answer their answers and get back to the conclusion that my argument was right to begin with. So I really have to do some work in advance getting into an adversarial interaction and process, thinking about what the opponent's arguments are and how I might respond to them and how the opponent might respond to me and how I might answer that to get us back to the conclusion that I gave you good arguments to begin with. So that's tip number five. Consider what the opponent might say and how I'm going to answer it. There's one more tip. Tip number six. You know what? No matter how good we might or might not get at this, there are times when we're going to need help, when we're going to need to get help. And so tip number six is, when it's appropriate, get the help of a professional. Use professionals when they're needed. Sometimes, even when I'm dealing with someone on the other side that I may not see as a total enemy or whatever, I really want to consult and get the help from an attorney. There are other times when I want to get an advocate who really knows about a particular subject area. So tip number six is just use professionals when it's appropriate. Don't hesitate. But with number six, you know, I say use professionals. Be careful here. Just like you're checking the credibility of what the evidence is, there's an enormous difference in quality between professionals. Pay attention and make sure you get a good one. Don't just get any professional. Really try to get a good one. That paying attention to that, giving that some attention, and maybe even spending some extra money on it, usually is well worth it. So when appropriate, get the help of a good professional. Those are my six tips. All right. We've talked about the adversary system. We've talked about how we need to learn it and use it, and we've got some tips for doing that. The adversary system, you know, was a great leap forward. That's clear. We've said that. We've made that clear, and we still need to use it. What we haven't talked about yet in this lecture is the downside, and there is a really significant downside. So let's turn to that at this point. Plato and Socrates, remember, said that the adversary system privileges winning at the expense of truth. Why did it do that? It's not that they articulated it that way, but the way I would talk about it is there is this underlying big thing that is the adversary system is competitive. It assumes that it's always competitive, which did that. We've noted that, you know, there's more to this downside. Some attorneys are better than others. Some actually do value winning over the truth, and courts do sometimes miscarry justice, even when they're doing their best. So citizens, you know, we have good reason to have doubts and suspicions about judicial processes and about politicians. The deepest flaw, though, the deepest flaw when it comes to managing conflict in the adversary system is the assumption that went right along with substituting verbal combat for physical combat. It's the assumption that it was combat, that it's competitive, that in order to get a winner, I'm going to have a loser. And we inherited that assumption. We inherited right along with the ability it gave us to resolve issues. And that assumption, it turns out, is costly. When we resort to the adversary system, it's going to hurt us anyway. It may cost less than doing physical violence, but we can do a lot of harm to individuals and relationships. There's a lot of evidence these days about how much children of divorcing couples are scarred and damaged when that couple fights the divorce out in court and they're being fought over. Adversary process, very damaging. There's bystanders getting hurt in addition to whatever's being done to the couples. The personal, the relational, and the material costs to organizations can be huge. It's striking to me that large organizations, and as for that matter, even insurance companies, will often write enormous checks, hundreds of thousands of dollars, just to avoid having to go to court. Way more things get settled out of court than in court. And it isn't always because that's just better. It's just very expensive to go fight it out. So they write checks and pay it off. Having recognized the problem, you know, there are efforts to mitigate it. Attorneys and even prosecutors now will negotiate settlements without going to court to avoid it. Judges will very frequently order disputants to seek a mediated negotiation before actually litigating something in court, and that includes couples trying to get divorced. In legislative bodies, instead of just arguing it out, debating, and then voting lots of times, they'll find it's more useful and constructive to sit down at a table across from one another and work something out informally together and then go back and vote that in. That can have a downside too, but they're getting away from the cost of arguing it out. It's just too expensive. So that assumption of competitive brings upon this expensive, can be damaging sort of things. That's an enormous downside we're going to have to get past. So what have we learned about the adversary system then? Number one, we learned that the adversary system substituted verbal combat for physical combat. Number two, and we learned that that is the greatest single improvement in conflict management in human history. At least that's my judgment concerning that. It was just absolutely huge. We still need it 2,500 years later. It has held up exactly that well. So we're going to be called upon to use it. So you better understand the adversary system and you better have at least some skill in it in order to do well in society these days. We gave you six important tips for doing that. One was understand forensic reasoning. Two, recognize the issue. Three, consider the credibility of the evidence carefully. Four, check your own logic. Five, look out for the opponent's argument and how you're going to respond to that. Six, get good professional help when you need it. Those are the six initial tips. We paid attention to the downsides. It does sometimes privilege winning over being right. It can be terribly expensive, and it keeps us trapped in that assumption that it's competitive. That's what we learned about the adversary system. Here's an assignment for you at the end of that one. Understanding and skill of argumentation really are essential. So here's what I want you to do. Think about your own level of skill in argument. If you don't think you're very good at it, don't sell yourself short. Don't get stuck in that idea that I can't think logically. All of us can and do. But every one of us can get better at it. So here's your assignment. If you're not really satisfied with your ability to argue, go take a course in it, read a book about it, do something to build that up. Set an objective for yourself to strengthen your ability to argue rationally in an adversarial process, and then follow through on that. That's the adversary system. Okay, where are we going to go from there? We're going to come back up 2,500 years. That assumption stayed unchallenged about competitiveness for 2,500 years until the mid-20th century, when in 1948, a doctoral student raised the question, does it have to be competitive? That graduate student was a guy named Morton Deutsch, and we're going to talk about Morton Deutsch and the concept of win-win in Lecture 3.